Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together, because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
The Republican Party has been losing the black vote since 1936. And despite, you know, little blips here and there where it may move from 7 to 8 or 8 to 9 or 9 to even 10% in presidential elections, that trend line moving away from the party has been fairly consistent. How has black conservatism evolved since then? And what has or hasn't been done to attract black voters to the Republican Party? I know I tried, but there's more to the story. And I'm very happy to welcome to the conversation today, Leah Wright Rigueur. She is Associate Professor of History at the Johns Hopkins University, my alma mater, and the author of the award-winning book, The Loneliness of the Black Republican, Pragmatic Politics and the Pursuit of Power. We're going to talk with Leah about the transactional nature of Black Republicanism, and a whole lot more coming up next on the Michael Steele Podcast, right after this. Welcome, everybody, to the Michael Steele Podcast. I am excited for this conversation today because I'm the loneliest of Black Republicans, and I've got a lady. I've got a lady with us who's written about that loneliness. I'm so excited to have you here, Lee. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be here.
You know, just a brother and a sister in the neighborhood talking politics. That's what we do. That's what we do. And yeah, the fact that you're also an associate professor of history at my alma mater just makes it all the better, you know. So we go Blue Jays and we got that. So it's all good. It's all good. So you have intrigued me for a while, and certainly your book, The Loneliness of the Black Republican, Pragmatic Politics and the Pursuit of Power, some writings that you've done recently in publications where it's appeared, The Post and The Root, where you're talking about Black Republicanism. So let's before we get into a lot of the crazy that is oftentimes associated with Black Republicanism, set the stage for us, because I think people really don't fully appreciate the historical context. You know, we look at African-American politics today, and we tend to see it through the lens of the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. But that was not always the case. In fact, it was not always the case for close to 120 years. And, you know, at least 100 years. And then you get into the late 60s and the early 70s, and you see this breakaway from the GOP from, I think, the way I look at it, Lee, the party leaving Black folks, not Black folks leaving the party. And so we can... we can talk about that, but set that. Let's take a historical trip back and understand exactly what this landscape looked like and how it's fashioned today.
Sure. So I think the first thing to keep in mind is that Black voters are the most partisan group voting demographic that there is.
Right.
you know, since, and I'm sure you're well aware of this, but since 1964, Republicans have gotten, you know, no more than at max 15% of the Black vote in presidential elections. Right. It's a little bit higher, you know, this again as well. It's a little bit higher in state and local elections. But if we're looking at the national level, right. I mean, Black voters are gone. At any given time, there are roughly, you know, if we look at Congress, roughly 80 to 85% of congressional representation amongst Black people is within the Democratic Party. So it sets up this assumption that all Black people are Democrats, right?
Right.
I actually argue in the book and in some of my other writings that this is a very, I think, unsophisticated reading of Black political behavior. And in fact, it can be a little bit of a dangerous reading of Black political behavior, particularly since that partisanship actually obscures a very complex, sophisticated, and very nuanced sense of voting behavior amongst Black people. Now, back to the partisanship. Why have Black people been so partisan in their behavior? Well, it's because they're making very sophisticated judgments since really the 1960s about which party has been most helpful in getting them to the agenda of civil rights and racial advancement that they want. Doesn't mean that they believe the Democratic Party is perfect,
right.
But it means that in terms of pragmatism, the Democratic Party has been most useful or kind of transactional in its ability to get things done for Black people. Prior to this, though, we see that there is this very long history and very long relationship between African Americans and the Republican Party. You may have heard this, especially it's been touted a lot recently, but the Party of Lincoln, right?
Yes.
The Party of Lincoln, which
I define myself as a Lincoln Republican. So,
Right. And it's the truth. From the moment that Black men received the right to vote in, you know, in the aftermath of the Civil War, African Americans find themselves firmly kind of enshrined under the banner of the Republican Party. After all, Lincoln freed the slaves.
Oh, yeah, I've heard that a lot.
And this remains true until roughly 1936. Now, 1936 is an interesting year because it's not the first year that Franklin Roosevelt is elected president, right? That's actually 1932.
Right.
And what's fascinating is that Black people don't abandon the Republican ship until 1936, so 4 years later. And that's when they start showing out in droves. They support Roosevelt largely because of the economic benefits of the New Deal and some of the civil rights initiatives that are ushered in by the New Deal and the First Lady, Eleanor Roosevelt. But they're still not Republicans. They're not identifying. I mean, they're still not Democrats. They're not. Right. They're still identifying as Republicans. That's big switch. That a switch in affiliation doesn't happen until 1948. 1948 is the first election year that we get Black people saying, well, no, actually, I identify as a Democrat. And a lot of that has to do with Southern Democrats branching off and forming their own party, the Dixiecrats, Strom Thurmond, right? South Carolina. Right. And therefore, the mainstream Democratic Party saying now is the time for us to use those alliances and expand that relationship. But it also falls on the Republican Party because the Republican Party starts falling down in its mission of civil rights. Right? So we see all of this kind of going back and forth, things going up and down, right? We have people like Adam Clayton Powell Jr., the famed congressman who goes all out for Dwight Eisenhower in 1956, right? He says, actually, Black people, you should use your vote and vote for Eisenhower. Why? Because he is angry at the Democratic Party. Feels like they haven't been doing enough. We see a split in the votes all the way up through 1960, right? Richard Nixon gets at least a third of Black voters to come over to his side in 1960. And even that is kind of a last minute decision. It's not until 1964, this really watershed moment.
64,
where the Republican Party selects as its nominee the one Republican senator who has voted against the most comprehensive civil rights act the nation has ever seen.
Yeah.
that has devastating consequences for the relationship between African Americans and the Republican Party, from which the Republican Party never recovers and apparently never really attempts to recover from.
You know, that piece, I really love that foundational laying there, because it's important for folks to understand that the ground we're standing on today was deliberately formed by the Republican mm-hmm. Party in its choice in 1964, despite the efforts of Republicans in leading the charge on civil rights with the Kennedy-Johnson administration, that you had play out in 64 and 65, despite the Goldwater nomination in 64, Republicans who would argue and make the case for and indeed pass the civil rights and voting rights laws on the book, you know, on the table at that time. And yet it was that choice in 64 to invite extremism into the party and its push, which would later play out in 1968 in Nixon's effort to win the presidency with the Southern strategy of inviting white segregationist men, the nouveau Strom Thurmonds, if you will, into the GOP. That sets in motion what we see playing out today. And in fact, in the late 50s, the John Birch Society tried desperately to get a foothold in the GOP, and national Republican leadership basically kicked their ass out, said, no, we don't want that. Yet and still, by 64, they would embrace some form of that. So this deliberate move to win presidential elections, because the presidency was won in the South in those days. You had to go through the South in those days. Really kind of set in motion what we see today. Your book, The Loneliness of the Black Republican, traces Black conservatism from 1936 to about 1980. How has that conservatism evolved during that time, but then even further evolve or devolve coming into the 21st century so that it looks and sounds very different today, in my view, than certainly the kind of Black Republicanism that myself, J.C. Watts, K. Cole James, and others were advocating and pushing within and outside of the Republican Party.
Sure. So I should give you two quick stories to preface this. The first one is, I actually did in the research for the book, I actually went up to the present day. It's just that it was just too much to include in one book. So I made a decision, because it felt like the right thing to do, to end roughly around the early 1980s. The second quick story is, as I was writing this, my former advisor from graduate school is like, you need to finish up. There were lots of people being like, who cares about Republicans and race and all of this stuff. And Michael, you won the Republican National Committee position.
Yeah.
And my former advisor sent me a note going, oh my God, your work is relevant. So thank you for that.
I'm glad I could help. At least my time as RNC chairman was worth something to someone. Yeah.
Jeez. But I think one of the things that it showcases is just how turbulent and elastic this timeline of quote unquote conservatism, what it has meant, how people have argued over it, how people have fought over it. You know, in 1960, you have somebody like Grant Reynolds working for the Republican National Committee. Now, if most people don't know who Grant Reynolds is, he is a Republican from New York. He served in the military And one of the earliest activist things that he does is that he is the co-founder of the Committee to Desegregate the Armed Forces, along with A. Philip Randolph. Mm-hmm. Now, everybody remembers A. Philip Randolph, right? If you go back and you look at those testimonies in front of Congress from the 1940s and the 1950s, it's Grant Reynolds who's sitting right next to him.
Right.
And his job after the armed forces are desegregated, his next job is working for the Republican National Committee. Now, Grant Reynolds says we have this ability to recruit African-Americans into the party. We already have a base from which to attract them from. He works with George H.W. Bush. They go down to Texas. They're in California. They're in New York, Michigan, Kentucky, all over the country. And Grant Reynolds starts to notice something around 1961. He says, why is money being redirected away from Black people and being put into white demographics and white mm-hmm. audiences? Why are people who are focused on Black demographics and enhancing, expanding the party tent and using ideas of conservatism that are inherent within, I think, Black communities, faith, church, family, right. these kinds of things, why are they being excluded in favor of going after these white demographics that are deeply racist? And he picks up on the fact that over the course of a 3-year period, the RNC redirects almost all of its minority funds, right? And Black and minority funds. This also includes Latino funding away from those demographics and yep. recruiting those demographics and into recruiting the white South, particularly the segregationist white South. And so what we see in before 1964 is actually a mass exodus of Black folks out of the Republican National Committee. All of those people who are pulled in, who are their job is to expand the big tent, to like pick up on that Party of Lincoln theme, they are all essentially killed, right? Politically killed, or they resign in protest mm-hmm. in favor of what ends up becoming Goldwater conservatism, right? The foot soldiers of Goldwater conservatism. It's a dilemma that George H.W. Bush actually writes about as early as 1963. And he's like, look, I think that we should have a big tent. I want to include, there's a space right. for racial right. minorities in here. But I also see that Goldwaterism is on the rise, that that's the future of the party. And I'm not sure how we can reconcile the two. And the thing is, he's right. You cannot reconcile the two because Goldwater conservatism, what essentially becomes the starts off as kind of a fringe of the party, but quickly becomes the mainstream of ideological thought within the Republican Party, is a form of conservatism that sees non-white as inherently alien,
right.
as other, as not a citizen. And so I think what you see over the course of the 1960s, right on through the present day, are these two strains at war with one another.
And they have been. That is such an important point because I know it, I felt it, I've been in it since 1976 when I joined the party. Doing this internal struggle while at the same time trying to expand and push outward to embrace more people. You know, when I was national chairman in the first few months, you know, I ran into a lot of buzzsaws for a lot of different reasons. But the one thing I wanted to make clear was that Republican Party, that Goldwater Nixonian embrace of white nationalism, white male Southern conservatism, was no longer anchored in the party, would no longer be an anchor in the party. Because I saw this fight, had been a part of this struggle for so long. So I'm like, someone's got to break it, right? Someone's got to mm-hmm. say, time out, we're not doing this anymore. And so I gave a speech at the National Press Club and declared that the Southern strategy was over, done. Mm-hmm. We are no longer doing that. And it was interesting. You know, at once you had people going, yay. And at the same time, they're going, okay, so we really doing this? So what are we doing? We're not doing that, right? We're doing it. and so it became, the struggle still was still very much a part of it. And then it would just manifest itself differently. And so it begs the question when you're looking at the sort of the party structure itself and how this is coming about. You see the party grabbing at little things as if they're big things. So they make a lot of noise about the fact that, oh, Black men are voting for Donald Trump. Well, okay, y'all know what that's about, right? I mean, this is not an ideological embrace of conservatism. No. It is not a move to a self-declaration of I am a Republican, as other African-Americans would do generations before. What is that? Give context to what we're seeing today. And why people are misreading, if you think they are, I believe they are, what you see in the numbers when you've got, you know, these Black activists, and we'll talk about Black celebrities and Republicanism in a moment, what that really means and what's really going on there. It's not necessarily what you think it is or what it appears to be.
Absolutely. So first of all, this is the numbers that we're seeing now only feel a particular way because essentially the median is correcting itself in the aftermath of Barack Obama.
Right.
When you have a Black man at the top of the ticket.
Thank you.
The numbers for any Republican opposition are going to be abysmal.
Right.
They're just going to. Barack Obama checked every single box. He did everything right. Right. There are several. I think, Michael, maybe you included. But I remember when he ran, people were like, I don't want to be on the wrong side of history. I got to be a part of this.
Right. Right.
2016. Obama.
Although I voted for John McCain. So.
Right. OK. All right. We'll take that.
It's my boy.
But I think, you know, you can't, that is a novel point in time. But if we actually correct, we see that Trump's numbers, both in 2016 and in 2020, aren't outside, right, the norm of what we see before Barack Obama.
Right.
George W. Bush has extremely high numbers amongst Black men, but including Black people who are affiliating as Republican in 2004. Hurricane Katrina changes that dramatically. And part of what I think we're tapping into is that a lot of Republican, right, African-Americans' relationship to the Republican Party is highly dependent on the actions of the Democratic Party. So when African-Americans aren't feeling the Democratic Party or see very little difference between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, Republican Party's numbers inch up slightly. It does not signify some big ideological shift.
I know.
It signifies a protest vote.
That's
what's
it.
More, I think what's more, what we actually see more of is lower turnout, right? So the number of non-Black non-voters goes up. And the number of Black independent voters and of independent affiliation goes up. So I think part of what we're seeing when people are talking about, wow, look at these numbers, this is very much in keeping with the gender dynamic that has defined African-American communities for several generations, which is that there is some segment of Black men, right, a very small segment, because by and large, right, very, very small, by and large, Black men vote just like Black women, but for this very small segment, they are wooed by particular outward displays of whether it be machismo, whether it be economic concerns, right? There's like no one one uniting thing aside from gender. And so I think people see these numbers and they get excited, they get titillated, and they actually don't realize what the takeaway should be. One, the takeaway is this is no big ideological shift. Two, Democrats need to get their messaging together.
Well, good luck on that one.
But what I think what some Republican strategists have figured out is that amongst this sliver of Black men, they are highly susceptible to certain kinds of messaging.
Hence the Platinum Plan. Right. Because. Right. Platinum for Black folks is more than gold.
Right.
So we call it the platinum plan. And right. Yes, I'm for that. Oh my God, it's so.
Or I even think about, you know, several of these, you know, Black male celebrities who have come out and endorsed Trump, and much of it is transactional. Lil Wayne, right? Kodak Black are very transactional. Trump helped get them out of jail. That's easy,
who I'm endorsing for president.
That's who I'm endorsing for president. If I vote at all.
That's the dirty little question. Secret. Did you even vote in that election?
Right. Or even I think about somebody like Kanye West and Ice Cube, right? So Ice Cube has been seen in the rotation of conservative media, increasingly in kind of alt-right media. And much of his gripe comes from the fact that he feels shunned by the administration, right? Like the Biden administration has not taken him seriously. They have not met with him on his terms. They have not taken his ideas seriously. Kanye West was very similar, right? Barack Obama famously called him an asshole. Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump brought him into the office and said, I want to hear your ideas.
Well, so one asshole to another asshole. So that works.
Right? I mean, the one thing that I will also say is that Donald Trump understood celebrity in a way that other people don't give credits to.
How do you account for, I mean, it's certainly something that I focused on as national chairman, was how do I grow and expand that base? So the messaging was a very important part. And I want to get into the various strategies, everything from, you know, Mr. Bunche and his, I think I'm saying that correctly. Is it Bunche? Is it Bunche?
Bunch.
Bunch. Bunch. Ralph Bunch. And his efforts to get Blacks on, Blacks, mm-hmm. Republicans, or Blacks and Republicans on the same page to what we've seen with the autopsy and other types of strategies to bring minorities into the party and expand it. But there's also this new feature, which, you know, it's not new, but it was important for me at least, and I know it's important still to the party, but it's the approach is very different. And that is, how do you really grow and identify leadership, the kinds of candidates. So when I'm looking at the candidates that we ran in 2009-2010 cycle, where we had the Tim Scotts, the Nikki Haley's, the Susana Martinez's.
The United Nations, United Colors of Benetton, right? That's what they were calling you guys?
That's right. That's right. And for a good reason, because for the first time, we had a nationwide concerted effort mm-hmm. that brought out Republicans where we found them. So we had a very broad spectrum of Republican thought along that ideological line, but they were still Republican. Today, it's all sort of MAGA driven. So when you're looking at the emergence of Black candidates who are running, they tend to be more of the Byron Donald kind mm-hmm. of, Donald Trump's my boy, ride or die. He can do no wrong. Two-tier justice system and, you know, weaponization, all the talking points that feed white nationalism. Mm-hmm. How do these candidates compare? We're seeing an unprecedented number of Black candidates mm-hmm. Coming into the Republican, running under the Republican banner, more than I had for sure. In many respects, in 2010, but they're different.
Well, they're absolutely different, and they will continue
just,
to be.
Let's just say that they're different.
They will continue to be different because there's a litmus test for getting support from the Republican Party, and that current litmus test is that you have to be an acolyte or, you know, essentially a sycophant for Donald Trump. And I think that is, you know, it's both terrible, but it's also the Republican Party doing business as usual, meaning that they are not going to invest in candidates that run the risk of incurring the wrath of the current standard bearer of the party. And like it or not, Donald Trump is the current standard bearer of the party. He is the leader of the party right now, indictments and all. And you know that he's the leader because all of the front runners in the, or not all the front runners, all of the people in the Republican right now party right now who have platforms, who even those who are running for president, essentially are just echoing Donald Trump's talking points, right? And we can get into like what those talking points are, where they come from or what have you, but there is no reward, at least within the Republican Party, for criticizing the current standard bearer of the party. And we kind of saw this a few months ago when there was this kind of really short movement, kind of fizzled out, to say, well, hey, guys, maybe having a candidate who is indicted, who lost, who like is in all this kind of
right.
like political muck and really did cause us a lot of problems, maybe he's not the best person. And the backlash to that was overwhelming, right? The base was like, no, this is who we've chosen and you need to respect that. And so I think, you know, Republicans have learned, and Black Republicans in particular have learned, there is no reward to charting your own path independent of the party flag bearer. So now we've seen a couple of people who have tried to navigate around Trump, right? Sidestep him in their attempt, but it's somewhat of a kind of, it's a delicate balance. The person I would be watching right now is Tim Scott, who is running for president and has been one of those people who has been trying to sidestep or basically just not acknowledge that Trump exists. And eventually it's going to come to a head. He's going to have to address it head on. And how he addresses it is going to be critical. Now, here's the thing, though. Trump is not someone who is going to bring new Black people into the party.
Right.
He's absolutely not. The Black people who are in the party right now, the Black people who are voting for the party, are just Republican, Black Republicans coming home, right? In the aftermath of Barack Obama. It's the mean going, resetting itself and going back to quote unquote normal.
Right.
So Trump, if anything, tends to drive away, right, new expansion. Any kind of like, and here's the crazy part. Michael, you know this. Republican strategists know this. They know that Donald Trump is not going to get 50% of the Black vote, as he claimed on more than one occasion. Oh, I think he claimed 95% at one point. And in order to do that, right, to see that kind of transformational flip that we saw in 64 and 36, two things would need to happen, and they would need to happen simultaneously. The Democratic Party would have to have an utter collapse.
Yeah.
It would have to be an implosion, right? Which is not out of the realm of possibility.
It's not out of the realm of possibility, but they've taken on and become much more the party of and for democracy, which gives them a new platform on which it moves them off of some of the policy matters that could create that separation for some Black people.
And the second thing the Republican Party would have to do is they would have to institute a series of policy changes that directly affect the material and lived conditions of Black people. Black people would have to feel it positively.
Take
those two things.
You put those two together because that's perfect. You're going exactly where I want to go next. We have to take a quick break, though. But this is the perfect setup for Ralph Bunche. And not just Ralph Bunche, but also Black conservative or militant Black Republicanism, of which I claim myself, and Jackie Robinson. So we're gonna dive into that in a moment, but we're gonna take a quick break. I told y'all this would be a great conversation. I don't know about y'all. I don't think I have enough coffee in this cup to get through. This is so good.
Enough tea.
There you go. I got the popcorn over here. I got the coffee over there. We are set, having a wonderful conversation with Lee Wright Rigueur.
Lee Wright Rigueur. There you go.
I got it right. I know a little bit of my French. But we're gonna return in a moment and talk a little bit more about the loneliness of the Black Republican right after this.
I'm Rick Wilson, host of The Enemies List. Every week on The Enemies List, we talk about the things, the people, and the issues that are breaking America and what we can do about it. I have conversations that are about a half an hour long with some of the smartest people in America. We're not just looking to criticize people, we're looking to figure out what the hell we're going to do with this country. The Enemy's List is a fast, compelling conversation, and I hope you'll join us. Like, subscribe, wherever fine podcasts are sold. You know the drill. The Enemy's List, produced by Resolute Square. I'm your host, Rick Wilson, and I hope you'll join us on The Enemy's List.
Welcome back, everybody, to Michael Steele Podcast. Like I said, we are having a great conversation with Lee Wright Regeer, who is the author of The Loneliness of Black Republican, Pragmatic Politics and the Pursuit of Power. Lee, before we went to break, we were talking about, and you made a very important and critical point on two things that would have to happen in national politics to cataclysmically upset and change the paradigm mm-hmm. that we currently have relative to Blacks in the Republican Party, one being Democratic implosion, complete implosion, where both policy and otherwise they become irrelevant to Black mm-hmm. voters. And two, Republicans would have to affirmatively put forward efforts and policies that directly impact pragmatically the economic interests of African Americans in the country, which leads me to a couple of very interesting and fascinating points in history. In a great conversation you had with Ezra Klein, you brought up, he brought up, and you got into the conversation around how the Republican Party began to move off of some of those key things that were of interest to Black folks. And there was this effort put in place by Ralph Bunche, who was invited to come in and help them. Where have we heard that before? Mm. Can we find a Black man to help us get this right? And so they get Ralph, and Ralph said, all right, I'm happy to come in and put together an effort here about how the New Deal has failed the Black community, mm-hmm. and how Republicans can further attract what was then the beginnings of the losing of that Black vote. As you rightly mm-hmm. noted, it began in 36. The party took note of it and wanted to do something about it. And one of the things he noted that the Republican Party should be, you know, should go further into its policies, no longer relying on the spirit of Lincoln and the well-worn, even at that point in time, well, Lincoln freed the slaves. Mm. Where have we heard that before, right? Excuse me. But the critical thing was, He wanted to argue and wanted the party to argue publicly that, you know, more effectively on health care, calls for mm-hmm. universal health care, more effective on Social Security relief, finance, agriculture, labor. In other words, putting the party in space one-on-one up against the New Deal. Right. Mm-hmm. And sort of expanding on some of those policies. But here was his caveat: happy to do it if and only if not only that you take this, but that you publicly release the whole thing, mm-hmm. that you this report that I'm going to do, put it out in public in the main, not don't cherry pick. Well, what did the party decide to do? Yeah, we'll do that. Sure. He does the report. It is a BAFO effort. He lays out exactly what should have been laid out and would effectively begin to rebuff and reposition the party relative to the New Deal. And the party said, you know what? We just want to put out part of it. We don't want to put out the whole thing. We just want to put out the part that basically attacks the New Deal. Mm-hmm. And he said, no. You publish the entire report or nothing at all. When I read that part of your interview with Ezra, I could not help but think about my own internal battles with the party, which is why I at times just took the radical side road and said, you know, started talking about hip hop republicanism, started talking about, you know, started wearing purple suits, you know, because my point was, all right, you guys don't want to do the messaging the way I want you to. I'm going to do the messaging myself, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Bunch, unfortunately, wasn't in that position where he could push the issue.
Mm.
But then you saw in 2012, Reince Priebus coming on the heels of the loss in 2012, trying to reset the party, comes up with the autopsy. Everybody's, oh, yes, it's great. We're going to do all these things to get Hispanics and Blacks in the party, particularly Hispanics, because that's the future.
Mm.
And then by 2016, they nominate a guy who says that Hispanics are largely murderers and rapists, and we're going to build a wall to keep them out. What does that say when you look at these two tales of the party saying, hey, we need help. Could you come and help us reach this new America that's emerging in front of us, mm-hmm. whether it's post New Deal or post or pre growth in Hispanic vote. And then the party goes, you know, on second thought, thank you for the report, but no, thank you.
So a couple of things. First, the one constant over this, you know, 100-year period is that the Republican Party has had the blueprint the entire time. It's not a secret. They keep coming back to it. They hire outside consultants. They pay them oodles of money. The consultants tell them the same thing that Ralph Bunche told them in 1936, again in 1939 and 1941. It's the same thing. It's the same thing every single time. So the response tends to be the same thing too, which is that the Republican Party reads the reports or they listen to the consultants and they say, you know what? This is brilliant. This makes sense. Absolutely. They crunch the numbers.
Yes.
And then they say, actually, no. No. And I think the big thing is that, and sometimes consultants are very open about this, which is that they are afraid of losing that which makes up their base demographic. They are afraid, right? And there are a couple, particularly in the 1970s.
Well, what are they afraid of? Yeah. I mean, what is their, if your goal is to expand the party and you're looking at the national demographics, whether it's 1936, mm-hmm. 1976, or 2006, or what will be 2026, and certainly as we know by 2046, the country's going to be majority Hispanic and Black, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the party's going to be sitting on the sidelines with its thumb up its ass trying to figure out how that happened. Right. And the reality of it is in 1936, as you said, in 36, 38, 41, you know, 2012, you got a lot of paper telling you the future is now. It's here. It's coming. They ain't got to wait for it. It's here. These are the things you should do. Why is there such a reliance on white male Southern voters? Which mm-hmm. is a dying demographic politically, not necessarily. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying white men are dying, but in terms of their share of the vote, they're being outpaced by other demographics that the party doesn't want to lean and get in front of that, but instead think that their future rests with the Southern white men. Donald Trump talking about make America great again, harkening back to a white America of the 1950s that he grew up in, which is bullshit. It was just as bad for white folks in Appalachia as it was for Black folks in Mississippi in terms of the economic impact, which is mm-hmm. the emphasis of his narrative. So what is it? What are we missing inside the party that makes them think that, oh, our future is still with white men?
Whiteness is currency. Whiteness is money.
Sister laid it out. Never mind. Let me go back to drinking.
And- You know, it's interesting because the Republican Party has repeatedly, I think, attacked the Democratic Party for over-reliance on identity politics.
Oh, they do it all the time.
They do it all the time without actually acknowledging that they themselves rely heavily on identity politics, right? That there is a constant, and I think this is what people don't realize, is that behind the scenes, people are very open about the fact that they want to recruit white people. You know, Phyllis Schlafly, who died a couple years ago, mm-hmm. died right before Trump was elected in 2016, so never got to see it come to fruition, said in 2012, like, our problem is not, you know, getting a bigger tent, it's getting more white people to vote. And she was like, that's who we should care about. Like, we care about power. We care about white people. Like, what she said is she said the ugly parts out loud.
Yep.
And
now the party's acting on those ugly pieces, parts.
Well, I think the party thought for a long time it could play footsie with it, and it would be enough to retain power. And that they could play footsie with it while denying it publicly. Right. What's different about Trump is Trump came forward and was like, no, you can say the quiet parts out loud. It's okay. And was rewarded for it.
Right.
The second that he said Mexico is sending their worst, they're selling drug dealers, rapists, all of these things, that should have disqualified him from even being in the running. But the fact that the base ate it up and elevated him to the number one candidate in the primaries should have been not just a warning sign. That should have been a neon billboard in Times Square, right? Being like,
but here's the rub. It was. And Lindsey Graham, Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush, all of these folks said, time out. Y'all don't want to do this. This is not where we need to go. This is not Republicanism. This man is not a conservative. He is not ideologically linked to anything inside of our party. Politically, he is a tried and true Democrat, and he's not even a good one. And at the end of the day, this is not the direction we want to go. And then these MFers, in a heartbeat, flipped the script. Yeah. Was that because of that, to the point you just made, that base suddenly going, oh shit, we can be racist in person, out loud, we can embrace our whiteness in a way that we felt we could not before, when that really was never part of what Republicanism espoused, was this idea of being white first. You see what I'm saying?
Saw the writing on the wall.
They saw the writing.
And I think what is, you know, one of the clearest indications of this is, you know, the we nearly had immigration reform, right?
In 2006, correct.
Right. And it failed, but the majority of people in Congress supported it. It is now an anathema to support immigration, right? You can be ousted from the party from this. And I would say one of the things to point out is that even as political leaders supported immigration reform, the base consistently since 2008, 2007 has not supported a pathway to immigration, right? A permanent pathway to immigration. So I say that that's a long-winded way of saying that the base has enormous amount of power. And what happened with Trump is that he was the match, right? They were the kindling. They've been looking for a match for a very long time.
Yep.
Political elites in the Republican Party had been unwilling or unable to do that. And so I think you see people like Lindsey Graham, Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, right? Who were, you know, were deeply entrenched within conservatism, looking and saying, there is no other way.
Yeah.
Right? There, this is. And I always tell people to pay attention to the loyalty component of polling, right? Because beginning in roughly August 2015, right, you look at the loyalty numbers of the different candidates, and Trump never dropped below 90%.
Nope.
Right. It meant that even that moment where like Ben Carson overtook him in the polls, right? It was like a hot second in November 2015. That wasn't real, right? Ben Carson's loyalty component was like 27%, meaning people were like, I don't really know if I'm going to support him, but for now I will.
Right.
Trump's base was like, we are with him. We are with him to the end.
Why that's important in the context of what we're seeing playing out right now as Republicans stand on a stage to debate the man who's not even going to be there because he doesn't give a shit about the process. And has made it very clear, not only will I not sign a pledge, I'm not even going to show up now. He's already said yesterday, I don't see a need to do any debates with any of these people. Mm-hmm. That touches to the core of what you just said. It explains, you have now given me the final piece of this, which I always thought was there, but now I connect the dot. When I saw the focus group, and I talk about this a lot on the podcast, so people have heard me say it before, in explaining Trumpism and why I think the press and the political class still get it so wrong is for what mm-hmm. because of what you just said. In trying to understand it, you need to understand that, oh yeah, we'll dance and dally all over the place. We'll look, even right now, people talk about, oh yeah, we need somebody else. I think we're kind of past Trump. We're done with Trump. But those bitches ain't going nowhere. They are loyal to him. Mm-hmm. They are loyal to him like a hoe to a pimp. Mm-hmm. And that's about as street as it gets. At the end of the day, you can whip it, flip it, smack it down. The reality of it is I'm going right back. And that explains the white female mother of two divorced from New Hampshire, who in 2016 in a focus group in October of that year was asked, why are you supporting Donald Trump? And she said, and I quote, because he's just like me.
Mm-hmm. And boom. I think he says that right there.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back right after this.
Trump is, I mean, he's new money rich, but he is elite, but not elite in the way that these other elites are. And he understands, like, he does something when he's on stage that I think a lot of people just completely miss and they misread, which is he says, I'm like you. I hear you.
Yes. Right?
I hear what you are saying to me.
Yes. Yes.
That is identity politics.
It's total identity politics.
I think about an interview I saw right after the 2016 election. It was a woman. I think it was in the Washington Post. It was a series of interviews, and it was women, men, all of this stuff. And time after time, when they said, you know, what lost you? You know, when did you decide that Barack Obama was, you know, something, and then you started looking at a person like Trump? They said Trayvon Martin.
Mm-hmm.
Trayvon Martin, and when Barack Obama said, Trayvon could have been my son. And they said, when they heard that, they knew Obama wasn't for them.
Mm-hmm.
So when Trump says, I hear you, I see you, I love you, I am like you, he's not saying like, oh, I see the general populace, right? His audience is all white, except for the people that stand behind him.
He says, I see your whiteness.
Right? I see your whiteness. I hear your complaints. Yep. Your complaints are valid.
And Obama translated it to, when he said Trayvon Martin could have been his son, that was to the exclusion of your whiteness, because my son is white. So you couldn't see my son. You wouldn't see my son.
Mm-hmm.
What they missed, what those bastards missed, was what he was saying was, I see a young man who could have been my son. He wasn't focusing on his race so much as he was focusing on what's happening across. I mean, because they're white kids. I mean, what about white? What about the equivalent age white child who's dying from drugs or from fentanyl or?
What about Obama crying at Newtown?
Thank you. He cried for their children. And yet they didn't see that. What they fixated on was his embrace of the death of a young Black kid. And so, well, that's to the exclusion of us. So that leads me to this. The one thing I've been noted for in my political journey and my evolution over the years is philosophically how I come down. As I tell people, I'm more like Malcolm X than Martin Luther King. In fact, J.C. Watts loves to refer to me as Malcolm X in that radical sense. But it was really kind of brought home for me by Jackie Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
Because Jackie Robinson, I think people don't appreciate what he was trying to tell the Republican Party back in the day in 1966 and beyond. They got lost in the fact that here was this very prominent African-American who was claiming Republicanism, and that's all that mattered. But what they missed was this baseball icon saying this, quote, "I am not what is known as a good Republican."
Mm-hmm.
All right. "I am certainly not a safe Republican.
Mm.
I am weary of the black man going hat in hand, shoulders hunched and knee pads worn to Uncle Tom, to the enemies of our progress." And it said a lot to that's my philosophical orientation. That's where I come down. I am not a good Republican, and I am damn sure not a safe one. And the party knows it firsthand, which is why they respond to me generally the way they do, right? But what I try to do is hold the mirror up and say, nor mm-hmm. should you be, right? Because our radicalism is born out of the roots of how the party was formed and why it was formed and for whom it was formed, in essence. So it really speaks a lot to me about the party's approach to race and how these pieces come about. You make note of that in your piece on Jackie Robinson. And I really commend people read it. It's titled Jackie Robinson, Militant Black Republican. Talk to me a little bit about, as you know, quote, "Conservatives have tried to claim the political legacy of Robinson without acknowledging his actual complicated militant politics," right, "of which I identify." How does that translate in the face of pseudo-Republicans like Candace Owens, who, you know, we have her on tape at a hearing in 2018, 19, declaring she's a Democrat, but never mind that. Grift is a grift. And Byron Donalds of Florida, who is all in on Trump, you know, and sort of doing the, you know, look at me brand, kind branding of Trumpism. How do you see these polar opposite positions in light of today's party?
Jackie Robinson was willing to risk it all. I mean, he walked away from the Republican Party. He walked away from his former friend. When Richard Nixon got the nomination, he was like, absolutely not. This is a person who had campaigned, had done something insane. It's like over 50 stops in like 40 days during the 1960 campaign, who had begged Nixon to do something about getting King out of jail when he was jailed in the midst of the 1960 presidential campaign. He was like, Richard Nixon is a racist. He's not my friend. And the Republican Party has gone off the deep end. They have gone off the deep end. He went on live TV in 1964 during the 1964 convention and was like, Barry Goldwater is Hitler. I feel like this is Hitler, like this is Nazi Germany all over again. And I will be president of Republicans for Johnson, right?
Right.
I will help the opposition get elected because that's how strongly I feel about this strain of pseudo-conservatism that is now in the party. It is the pseudo-conservatism of racism, of bigotry, of xenophobia. And I think his willingness to do that, his willingness to, quote, in his own words, be a thorn in the flesh of the Republican Party and the thorn in the flesh of the GOP, was something that is atypical now. Particularly because what happens when it's not necessarily novel to Jackie Robinson, but roughly around that time, because it's such a polarizing moment, right, with the nomination of Senator Barry Goldwater as the Republican nominee, we begin to see an explosion in kind of Black Republican opportunism. People who realize that if they endorse, right, this kind of vile form of conservatism, who are willing to denounce Black people, to engage in shenanigans on behalf of the Republican Party that disempower and disenfranchise Black people, that they will be rewarded for it. They'll either be rewarded with it in terms of influence. They'll be rewarded for it in terms of prominence. They'll be rewarded with it, with access to, you know, political players and power players. And that has only been exacerbated with the advent of technology and new kinds of technology. And so we have all these articles that come out in the 1980s about the rise of the new Black conservatives, right? And we also have, there's a wonderful study by Corey Fields around that's based on data from 2016, roughly, that shows that Black Republicans who speak honestly about their detachment from the party or critique the party are punished, right? And they don't have the kind of platforms that people who uncritically echo whatever the party platform is, right? Mm-hmm. Whatever the party leaders say, the kind of rewards that they get.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I see is the explosion and kind of an opportunistic Black Republicanism that has been only increased by the development of new kinds of technologies, including social media.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have, right, the people, you know, Mike, I'm taking you out of this conversation, but the people who are willing to, I think, do the kind of work that Jackie Robinson was willing to do in 1964, mm-hmm. through his death. I think what we have is an increase in kind of transactional Black Republicanism, particularly for people who are trying to think about, how do I attain power? Right? Now, do I think any of these people are powerful? I think Clarence Thomas is powerful.
Yes.
But amongst, I think, the bit players, right, like particularly these new players, not necessarily powerful, but certainly they are influential,
mm-hmm.
right?
Who are they influencing? Right. They're not influencing. Jackie Robinson could command the attention, yeah, of the Black community, right?
So right, they're certainly not influencing Black people.
Right, So, because my take inside the GOP has been, mm-hmm. which is, again, going back to some of the issues that I've had inside the party, you know, for example, you know, I tell the story of the day I was elected, a member of the committee greeted me with a nice big hug and a smile and said, now Blacks will join the Republican Party. And my response was, I'm not a Pied Piper.
Right.
Right. Black folks aren't going to wake up tomorrow morning and go, oh, you got, yeah, a Black man who's going, you know, now we'll join the party. But that's the kind of they want someone to feed that particular narrative that they think actually works. Right. That if we, you know, the whole thing with Byron Donalds being this next speaker of the Republican House was total, mm-hmm. bullshit. It was never going to happen.
Right.
Yet he allows himself to be put up in that form, knowing it wasn't going to happen, yeah, to be used that way. And having it end with the image of him being, right, patted on the head by a white member of the Republican Party when the effort failed. You sit there and you scratch your head and you go, well, who are you doing this for? Right. Who and I guess
there is absolutely no one, right, amongst all of these people, there is no one that powerful or influential as to influence a massive shift, right, a transformational shift,
right,
amongst Black voters. What they do have the ability to do is, I think, influence the inner workings of the Republican Party, provided that they stay within the boundaries of what the party, you know, a flag bearer wants.
And there you are.
And there you are, right?
That's something I was really good at.
There is, you know, there's somebody like Clarence Thomas is powerful because he sits on the most powerful court in the land.
Yeah.
Right. And because over the course of the last few years, the balance of the court has transformed. So now he has the ability to be a power broker. Hence all of these, you know, it's now all coming out, but all of these Republican lobbyists and you know, donors basically whining and dining him over the last 20 some odd years.
He's a good Republican. He's a safe Republican.
Correct. And he echoes, if anything, he's to the right of, you know, of the party line. Like he's with the fringes, right? We certainly know that his wife is with the fringes. But he has the ability to affect policy. He is determining law. And so I say that's why I identify him as an incredibly powerful figure. But in terms of these kind of other things, they're still very much static. They're contained within a box and boundaries and essentially limited by whatever the party needs them to do or to be.
And that's where the Black celebrity piece also comes into play, mm-hmm. where they tap into that and use that, the Kanye West, for example, the Herschel Walkers, as sort of the sort of setup narrative of projecting, see, we've got one, two. Actually, right. we've got two that we can put out, right? But what that...
And, well, it's a, I think it's certainly a fast track in politics, right? If you come out tomorrow and you decide, I mean, a lot of people have the young woman who ran for office in Maryland and lost, like Kim Kulak, Kim, I think her
name
is.
Classic.
Went viral, had the former president endorsing her, raised millions in small, online donations, but couldn't win, right? Didn't even come within the realm of possibility of winning, which is why the various Republican committees were like, we're not going to give her money. We're not going to support her because she has no chance in hell of winning.
Right.
Which is a smart, practical decision. She was very angry about it and spoke very openly about it. But it was also fascinating that the party was like, we're not going to pay you any mind. Mm-hmm. So there's a fast track, I think, to getting a lot of attention. And I think she went on to getting various surrogate money and things like that. And she will probably begin to make the circuit again come the 2024 election. Certainly there's a fast track to that. But beyond that, I'm not sure what it affords you. Right? Like Diamond and Silk, for example.
Mm.
What does that get you?
It got you Donald Trump standing up at the funeral of which one passed, I forget. And not even remembering her name.
Right. And I even think about, there's a complete study, a very serious study that needs to be done on somebody like Herman Cain.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about Herman Cain, who passed away during the pandemic of COVID, and how his death was barely acknowledged. His death and his legacy was barely acknowledged, despite him being an exceptional booster for the Republican Party, particularly in very dark times, right? Like he was at a Trump, event mm-hmm. where that's allegedly where he caught COVID. It's horrific. And so I just really wonder for many of these people who are thinking about it, like what is the payoff? And I will tell you though, for a lot of these people, including the kind of small time folks, right? Like the people on Twitter who have 100,000 to 1 million followers who are like doing comedy shows or radio shows. One of the things that we know is that it's great for business. You may not have any influence, but you know what? Your rent and your mortgage will be paid at the end of the day.
And it's capstone, the way you put it, the transactional Black Republicanism that has emerged and replaced the principled, narratives of a Jackie Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you have a Jackie Robinson who was trying to course correct the party and made it very clear what animated his Black Republicanism, now being replaced by sort of the media antics of a Diamond and Silk, and it was Diamond, Anithia Hardaway, who passed away, mm-hmm. Where Trump is at the funeral praising her and not even remembering meeting her in the Oval Office, but the transaction is all that matters. You can make the claim Trump quote knows me, or guess how much I can raise now if I go out here and do the step and fetch it circuit, then I'm accepted by a party that really isn't accepting me.
I also think I also think about, you know, when pushed even a little bit, I think on the policy side of things, many of these kind of, whether it be acts or actually genuine, you know, people who are affiliated with the Republican Party or surrogates, it tends to collapse, right? Like I think of particularly the celebrity side of things.
Yeah.
You know, you have somebody like Kanye West saying, I don't pay attention to policy. Policy is irrelevant. And you're like, so you weren't aware, you know, quote unquote, the Muslim ban. He's like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Right. I have no idea what you're talking about. It's like,
you know, oh. I think about somebody like Ice Cube, who I do think has a valid, you know, a valid proposition when he says things like, I really care about investment in Black communities and sure. things like that. And you say, okay, so can we talk about like, what do you think of what the Biden administration, like these policies, this policy here, this investment, or, you know, that like the inflation, the right. de-inflation act or something like that. And he'll be like, I don't really pay attention to those details. I just know Biden's not doing it. And, you know, and so I think about, I think a lot about that. And this, again, is not saying, it's not to say that everyone has to be a Democrat, right? Like, I firmly right. do not believe with that whole right. mess, right. you know, Biden, you're not Black if you don't vote for the Democrats. Absolutely not.
Right.
But what we do know is that there is a superficial understanding of policy and implications, the implications of that policies, and then the impact of those policies on Black lived experiences, and more broadly, like poor and working class experiences, that just is unable to be translated because the whole, you know, to use your term, the whole grift is like, hustle and get money.
Yeah, well, no, it's exactly, that's it. Hustle again, money, and which is why, and I'm going to close this out with this because I know I've kept you longer than I promised I would. This has been so, so good. It's been cathartic for me, I have to tell you, honestly.
Good.
Leah, it's really been cathartic for me in so many levels. But you referenced my friend, my buddy, and I really do consider him that, given the trenches that we've been in together. But I'm very disappointed in the way he's running his presidential campaign, because I know he knows better. And that's Tim Scott. When he tweeted out, I remain concerned about the weaponization of Biden's GOP and its immense power used against political opponents, in referencing the 90 plus indictments of Donald Trump. My response was, stop the BS. Just stop your BS. You know damn well there aren't two different tracks of justice. Did you put classified documents in your bathroom or try to overturn an election? Right. If you did, and this is important, you know where you'd be right now. As a Black Republican, mm-hmm. you know damn well where you would be. And mm-hmm. not one Republican, not one, would be spouting GOP talking points on your behalf to nope. save your ass. Not nope. one.
And be like, lock him up.
And that's the point that I think a lot of current Black Republicans miss about this party that has gone unchanged since 1936.
And I
go ahead. I think you get the last word, obviously.
Tim Scott's going to have to address it at some point, because he's trying to play a game right now where he appeals to the base, which is largely Trump's base,
right?
And tries to defeat a figure like Trump, right? He's casting himself as essentially as another option.
Right.
But at some point, he's going to have to address it head on. The problem is, because the base does not like the indictments, because the base feels like they are illegitimate, he has to play into that. And so I think what we see now is him again trying to duck and to dodge. But at some point, you're going to have to stand up. DeSantis is going to have to do the same thing too.
Yeah.
I don't know that they will actually be able to do it. I don't think they will.
I don't think they will either. And the debate will tell us whether or not they at least began mm-hmm. to try. Leah Wright Rigueur, oh my gosh, this has been so much fun for me, and I know
it's been fun.
I apologize to your calendar and whoever you've got it supposed to be on the phone with next or talk to, but thank you for taking time to be on with me and to talk about the loneliness of Black Republicans like myself, who or, you know, I tell people I'm still a Republican. I call myself no longer so much a Lincoln Republican, but a Motel 6 Republican, because someone's got to keep the lights on. But it's harder and harder to do. But you've given us a lot to think about, and I appreciate you for it. The book is The Loneliness of the Black Republican, Pragmatic Politics and the Pursuit of Power. It's an award-winning book. I would ask you all to grab a copy and really begin to understand what the dynamics are and what's at play. Follow Leah on Twitter at Leah Rigueur, at R-I-G-U-E-U-R. So that
the U's hug the E.
Huh? What was that?
The U's hug the E.
The E. There you go. So follow her there. She's the associate professor of history at my alma mater, Johns Hopkins University. Go Blue Jays. And again, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Michael.
Oh, absolutely. It's a wonderful conversation. And I do very much intend to get you back on. Because this story ain't over yet.
Oh, no, no. Oh, we're just getting warmed up.
All right, folks, that does it for this this time together. Thanks again for joining us. Remember to do the voodoo you do the download thing. I love it when you do. Share this conversation with your friends on Twitter and Facebook and wherever you get your downloads. I really appreciate it. Until next time, be safe. Summer's coming to a close. We're getting into the fall. You know what that means. Crazy gets more stupid. So politics are afoot. Until next time, take care.
Is it just me, or have we all lost our minds? It's a question more and more people are asking themselves, afraid to admit they already know the answer. It's also a podcast, one about people coming together in a time of division and uncertainty to talk about culture and politics, compromise and connections. It's about challenging the norms we've come to accept as a society and working together to find common ground. Fierce and Unfiltered, host Jennifer Horn is a former Republican strategist and party leader turned independent sanity activist. One way or another, we've all lost our minds. Join Jennifer Horn in the search to find them again.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.